Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast. I'm John Schaefer, and yes, we are in our usual studio in Lower Manhattan, though you'd never know it from the sounds in the background, sounds that were recorded in Brazil by my guest, the singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Jonathan Myberg. He is the leader of the band Shearwater, and if you've heard any of their prior visits to our Soundcheck studio, you know that Jonathan is a serious expert on birds and has traveled the world searching for rare species, and this recording comes from a trip to South America where he was trying to chase down a very rare bird in the country of Guyana, next door to Brazil. He was doing that as part of a research project for a book that he's writing. So there are many things to talk about with Jonathan Myberg, not least among them the new album, Jetplane and Oxbow, by the band Shearwater, which includes this song called Quiet Americans. Is called Quiet Americans, and you will find it on the new Shearwater record called Jetplane and Oxbow, which comes out on January 22nd, although it is available for pre-order already. And Jonathan Myberg, well, here we are back in one of your soundscapes that you brought back from your trip to South America. Tell me first about the title, Jetplane and Oxbow.
I thought of the title on one of my trips between Austin and New York when I was working on the record. And we were flying over the Mississippi, and I looked down and I saw, one of those great big oxbow lakes off the Mississippi, which is this big loop of the river that closed over long ago and just became a sort of a comma or circle-shaped lake. And this other plane going the opposite direction just passed right through the middle of it. And so I just wrote down in my little notebook, Jet Plane and Oxbow, and I started thinking about it later, and I liked this sort of sleek, modern thing juxtaposed against this ancient landform. Mm. But then the word, the term jet plane, though, is a little bit antique, too. Like it's, like living on a jet plane. Nobody calls them that anymore.
No, it's very mid-20th century, isn't it?
That's true. But I liked that, too, because the record is, an idea that we started to have was that maybe the record was set around, 1980, because there were a lot of records that came out around then that realized I was listening to a bunch and really enjoying, Scary Monsters.
Scary Monsters. Sober Creeps.
Remain in Light.
Letting the days go by. Let the water hold me up.
Metal Box. Peter Gabriel 3.
If looks could kill, they probably will. In Games Without Frontiers. Without tears.
There are moments where those influences are pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
Do those become clearer when we get back to sort of the basic elements, the initial attempts at songwriting, the demos, the backing tracks?
You can sort of, if we go into that a little bit, you can sort of hear it start to happen, actually. The very first thing that we did, just as a place to start, because I figured we need to start somewhere. So I had this little fragment of us playing a drum pattern at I think it was a sound check at a club in Munich on the previous tour. And I just had it in my laptop, and so I made a little loop out of it, and then I started playing along with it. And that was just sort of a way for us to loosen up, and it never really went anywhere, so it's just filed under this thing called Munich. But I think it'd be good to listen to a little bit of it.
That's a little bit of a, what would we call this, a demo, a failed demo?
Yeah. They're not failures, they just, you know, they're...
They didn't go anywhere.
Their evolutionary lineage didn't make it to the present.
But, you know, what's interesting, there is a kind of change of chord towards the end of what is ultimately a three-minute-long fragment. So
yeah.
there was some kind of compositional idea that was being worked towards.
Yeah, and if we'd followed that, it probably would have continued to develop. I mean, sometimes you leave good ideas behind in the process. Maybe I'll come back to that one at some point. But for whatever reason, it just nothing, I couldn't get a lyric to stick to it, or I don't know. I thanked that one for getting us into the process and then put it down.
Well, so when you start layering backing tracks like this, basically what you're doing is you are creating the kind of sound environment for the song, and I don't want to stretch this analogy too far, but it's not too dissimilar from the idea of you standing knee-deep in a river in Guyana holding up a microphone and collecting that soundscape and hoping against hope that this bird is going to fill it with song.
It's something's going to turn up. I mean, it really does feel like more of a listening process than a sound-making process in some ways. All throughout here, by the way, you're going to hear... I don't want to pretend that John and I are standing in the jungle or anything, but these are recordings that I made in southern Guyana and in Brazil while I was doing research for the book that I'm working on that we'll talk about more later. But to go back to one of the first demos that we did that actually did become the song A Long Time Away was this one here, which is just, you can hear us kind of getting on to the, you know, getting the train moving. And of course, we couldn't figure out how to stop it. This demo just ends, but it was fun once we got it going.
So this demo becomes the song A Long Time Away on the album Jet Plane and Oxbow.
You feel the shock in your eyes and the shaking in your own hand. Well, look around, old friend. You live under house arrest and you sleep undefended. You've been a long time.
Does that final song, A Long Time Away, does that contain the longest held note you have ever sung?
that was me kind of goofing on Danny, the producer. I don't know why it is, but for some reason it's really easy for me to sing these super, super long notes. I've been trying to learn not to do that, actually, lately. But that one, that we loved sort of torturing it with a tape delay that we had, so you could hear it start to really fray in this strange way on the final recording. But back when we were, you know, we didn't know that that was what we were going to do with it yet. We just knew it was this kind of fun little groove where I was hitting this 12-string as hard as I possibly could, and Lucas was banging the drums.
And what happens is, you know, you create, again, this kind of sonic environment, and because there's nothing on top of it, you're getting into Brian Eno territory. You know, you were talking before about albums from 1980. you know, Remain in Light, the album he did with David Byrne, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. Remain in Light, of course, was Talking Heads and Brian Eno. But that idea that what's in the background can be at least as interesting as what's in the foreground.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that you seem to be playing with a lot here.
Well, once I don't think I'm alone in thinking this, that once you put the vocals on the record, that's when you start to lose interest in it. I always feel like we've made these beautiful backing tracks and you ruin it with vocals. But luckily, I mean, nobody else listens to you. You don't, everyone's voice sounds bizarre to them recorded for the most part. And that doesn't ever go away for singers, by the way. But until you do that, you don't have that feeling of discomfort, I guess. So I like leaving things in this instrumental stage for a long time, but then eventually we do kind of buckle down and put the vocals on them.
Well, once you put lyrics to a song, you're kind of telling us what the song is.
Yeah, which is always a little bit frustrating. That's why I like having lyrics that are a little more impressionistic, that leave a little room for you in them, because I just don't like being yelled at. But you mentioned Eno, and one of the records that we were listening to a bunch was Before and After Science, which is sort of his last record of songs, I guess.
For many years, yeah.
I really enjoyed hearing what he was doing with the drums. He was just affecting the drums like crazy in that record.
In these metal ways, in these metal days.
I don't know if he played them individually or exactly how he put them together, but he did such strange things with them, so... We did one piece that also never got to the record stage, but it was super fun, where we were starting to do a lot of things with weird drum effects. That was an instrumental that we just called Yalla Yalla.
The musical direction you're talking about going in here with Jet Plane and Oxbow is definitely more rocking than a lot of Shearwater's prior. I mean, you've always tested those waters, but this record seems to have really taken the plunge.
Yeah, we got there finally on this one, although it was still, it took a while getting up to it. I mean, there were some songs that we left behind that seemed more like the things that we had done before or had a feeling we just didn't want to chase.
Give us the chronology here. How was the making of this record done in sort of parallel or in tandem with the trips to Guyana, to the Amazon?
Well, we actually had started working on it even before we did the Fellow Travelers record, so sort of an entire record and tour erupted in the middle of this record. And then we came back to it a few months later, and we're like, okay, wait, what was happening again? What were we doing? I had forgotten about these songs. It was interesting to hear that. It was like somebody else very similar to you had made them, but you'd forgotten that they did it. And then the trips happened mostly, I mean, I think I mastered the record a couple weeks before I left on the trip to Guyana. So I wouldn't say that they informed it exactly, but the music was still very much with me on those trips. And what's funny is that in Guyana, I ended up spending a lot of time on Oxbow Lakes off that river, which basically what we did in Guyana is I ascended this really remote river called the Rewa with a Canadian bird researcher named Sean McCann and three Amerindian men from a village called Yupikari named Brian Duncan, Josie George, and Rambo Roberts. And they were just awesome people to be with. They were so smart and funny and knew how to survive in that environment, whereas I'd have been dead in a week. The river's full of scary fish, electric eels and stingrays and... the piranhas are like the least frightening fish that are in that river.
Vampire fish?
Yeah, pyara. That thing's really scary. It looks like a beautiful sort of silver blue, almost like a salmonid type, trout or something. But then stuck on the end of it is this face with these huge eyes and these gigantic teeth, like one of those angler fish or something, It's enormous. This fish is like 3 or 4 feet long. And the two lower teeth that are like canines erupting out of the lower jaw are so long that they actually go up into a slot in its skull and poke out the top of its head between its eyes when its mouth is closed. You can imagine this. Imagine your teeth coming out your forehead when you have your mouth is closed.
Well, please tell me they're at least delicious.
They tasted okay. Yeah, they were all right. There were some other ones called Aymara that I put a picture on our blog about. I'm holding that one up. It looks like a coelacanth. And they just sit on the bottom of the river and bite whatever is in front of them, basically. And so you can, you know, if you drop a hook near one with anything on it, could be a carrot, anything, they just bite, and you pull them up, and they don't have much. They fight for about 10 seconds, and that's about all they got. So They taste really good.
But there's no swimming in this river.
No, I wasn't even, there were caimans. No, not about to. And we saw wildlife in there like tapirs, capybaras, harpy eagles, jaguars, pumas. I mean, stuff that's really hard to see. And it mostly looked at us like, what are you doing here?
So they're not used to seeing outside. They're not used to seeing people, I guess.
No, we had to portage over these waterfalls and things to get up into that region. It was just very, very, you know, you felt far away from the world in a lot of different ways, or closer to it, depending on how you want to look at it.
And so what's the status of the book? What's the publication date? How far along are you?
The book is supposed to come out in, I think, probably 2018. And it's a book about the sort of the history and evolution of South American wildlife and landforms through the eyes of the 10 living species of caracaras, which are these strange, super intelligent birds of prey that are from South America, and the people who live with them. And also this weird, very melancholy, mystical 19th century naturalist and novelist named William Henry Hudson, who was born in South America and moved to England and never returned.
Can you write a book in the 21st century about nature, wildlife, conservation, the environment, without it being a political work?
That's sort of like asking whether you can write a protest song. You know, David Bowie described Scary Monsters as social protest music, and I kind of wanted to take a cue from that for this record.
Well, you could see the opening and closing songs of Scary Monsters, the two versions of It's No Game.
Yeah.
You know, certainly a kind of as close to social commentary as Bowie has come.
Man, someday I'm going to do that. I'm going to just like go all out on a take and just shred my voice completely. But that's just, it's so, I love listening to him do that. It's one of the bravest openings for like a, you know, and that was a big rock record for like a guy who was going to play on the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
He could not get away with that now.
That is the throat-shredding version of It's No Game, Part 1, which opens the David Bowie record Scary Monsters, and in a very different version, closes it as well.
And it's no game.
So with his talk of documentaries on refugees and assassins and things like that, this is pretty close to social commentary. And Jonathan, we're talking about, you know, that end of things in the new Shearwater record. In this case, how does the political world kind of impinge on the songwriting? How is it? What evidence do we hear of it?
Well, the record in general has a lot of moments trying to look at different sort of either stories that other people tell about the United States or stories that we tell ourselves about the United States within the country. I like the song Wildlife in America, which is about a particular story that is sort of a meme, I guess, that's taken hold, I feel like, in the country.
To the back out of your rear eye.
Time over.
Wildlife in America. It's one of my favorites on Jet Plane and Oxbow as well.
Thank you.
The idea that you can nod to some of your heroes, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be Bowie or David Byrne or Brian Eno or Peter Gabriel, and still have something original to say, that's a fine line that a lot of bands have walked and toppled off of.
That's the risk of it, is if you go too far, you just end up in pastiche. And I think we didn't. It felt authentically like us to me and not like just we were playing dress up.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why it's so interesting to hear some of these demos, some of these instrumental backing tracks, because you can, for example, in the song Filaments.
Yeah.
There's a very strong Talking Heads flavor to the kind of initial version of that song, which is then transformed and transmogrified into something much more yours in the final analysis.
That was after we had done the demos. We did a first set of sessions with the drummer, Cully Symington, at Spoon Studio in Austin.
So that demo then becomes the song Filaments on the new Shearwater album, Jet Plane and Oxbow. Jonathan Myberg's final version of Filaments, a song from the new Shearwater record called Jet Plane and Oxbow. We're hearing some of the songs, some of the demos they came from, and some of Jonathan's location recordings on his research trips to Guyana in South America. You made a recording of these frogs in Guyana.
Oh, yeah. This was what it sounded like all night long in Georgetown.
It sounds like squeaky gates swinging open and shut over and over. I would never have pegged that for frogs.
Frogs make so many incredible sounds. They've learned to make everything from bullfrogs. You know, you think of to little tiny peeping and squeaking sounds. And some of them sound almost, there's a thing called a monkey frog. It has a weird, almost human kind of sound to it. Very unusual.
There's a piece on the new record called Stray Light at Clouds Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That title almost sounds like a nod to Brian Eno's On Land, his ambient record, which was full of frogs and birds and the sound of
Lizard
rooks
Point
and things
thing.
Like
Well, Clouds Hill was the name of T.E. Lawrence's little cottage near the RAF base where he lived for his life pretty much after he came back from Arabia. And T.E. Lawrence was Lawrence of Arabia,
of course.
And the cottage is still there. I've never been to it. I'm going to try to go, actually, in about a month. But Lawrence is just, I read a couple of books about him while we were working on the record, and I got really, as so many people have been, kind of pulled in by this guy, because he just doesn't seem like he's quite from his time. It's hard to say if he's before or ahead, but he seems very alive and very modern in a weird way. But his own adventures in myth-making for himself and to some degree for his country were, on the one hand, the greatest source of meaning and joy in his life, and also something he found sort of deeply repulsive in himself and tried to erase almost later. I mean, when he came back, he joined the Air Force as a recruit and worked as a mechanic in the Air Force for the rest of his life. It feels like almost a penance for what he had done. What he had done, in part, was reshape the entire map of the Middle East in a way that we are still dealing with in a very immediate sense.
Yeah.
So I hadn't really thought it all the way through like this before, but he's just such an archetypal example of what believing in certain myths about your country and yourself as a representative of your country can mean in the world. So that's where, it's not just a pretty place name.
Yeah. And what point in the writing of this song did that story kind of come to mind?
Well, I was thinking about, for this song, I wanted to sort of evoke drone pilots a bit too, and just sort of the way that the world can look at a remove. I was thinking of sort of like, kind of the dark side of the earth, like just like this globe with these little spots of light on it turning.
Climb to the cloud base, ride in the crosswinds, sleep in the open, slide through the fences, hide in the hallways, my armor is frozen, my horses are rested, my eyes are glittering.
Actually, things I like about this demo that I think are better than the final version that we made, although there's things about that I like better too. This often happens with demos. You never get exactly the same sound. And in fact, chasing the demo is a thing we talk about that you really shouldn't do. It's kind of like chasing that mythical animal, like you can't.
It's like the film director who falls in love with his temp score.
Yes, exactly.
This happened to Stanley Kubrick constantly.
Yeah, to the point that he finally gave it up, right?
Right.
Isn't there a whole score for 2001 that was...
That he didn't use because he just fell in love with the Ligeti and the Strauss and all the rest of it.
How can anything be better than this stuff?
Yeah.
And he was right. So we fleshed it out more in the actual version, but at the demo to this, I still... If I start listening to it, I end up listening usually to the end too. So I guess that's probably where we'll leave this for now, as an introduction to the record, I guess.
With Stray Light at Clouds Hill.
John, thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Jonathan, great to speak with you again. If you like Soundcheck, consider subscribing to our podcast. It's easy. Just find us in the iTunes store and click on Subscribe. We'll send you our latest interviews, in-studio performances, and more.